Guardians could use a bat. They could use three or four bats. Do they have the ammo to go get one? Should they go get one? Guy who's in the know joins us right now on the Fan Hotline from the MLB Network, MLB.com. He's one of the guys we go to in clutch situations like this. He's Mr. John Morosi. Hello, John.
Cooperstown, a great weekend, and I did love the updates from CeCe. After his car broke down on the way into town, we can now safely report he is in Cooperstown. So that is very good news indeed.
John, we just saw that. You're going to Cooperstown to get into the Hall of Fame, and
it's
your
a
car
long road
breaks
to
down.
The Hall of Fame. Yeah.
Come on.
I know. And I love just how genuine he was in sharing updates on his journey. And I'm sure that that will come up at some point in the next couple of days when he's speaking with all of us. But what a beautiful day. It's a little overcast. I'm going to be the optimist with respect to weather and just look ahead to three amazing speeches. And, of course, those posthumously for both Dave Parker and Dick Allen as well. So it should be a very, very special weekend.
It's always awesome up there, John. I can remember one year I covered the Jim Palmer, Joe Morgan induction, which got rained out and then moved into a elementary school auditorium, which gave it a real nice wow. sense of intimacy. So, yeah, and then you know, years later, the Hall of Fame has had to kind of adjust and figure out the weather up there, which is always changeable. So just in terms of the Hall of Fame, before we get into the trade deadline and stuff, just your reflections on, you know, kind of this class going in, you know, CeCe being obviously very connected here in Cleveland. Also Tom Hamilton going in, our fine right. broadcaster, along with Ichiro, quite a class. And you mentioned Dave Parker before.
Amazing class. And certainly I'm going to be thrilled to hear Tom's speech tomorrow at the awards presentation. I saw the headline. I can't recall where the article was, but it described Tom as everybody's best friend. And that is so true. I think certainly as someone that has covered the American League Central for a long time and spent a lot of time around Tom, just grateful for his friendship. And I think that puts me in the small company of millions of people, it seems, around this country. And just someone who, as you know, more than anything, he's a proud husband, a proud dad, loves the game, loves the people in the game. And I do think it's just so fitting that he's got a chance to go in same year as CeCe, someone whose career he chronicled so beautifully on the radio there in Cleveland. So just a first-class representative of the game. And I cannot wait to hear Tom's speech tomorrow. And he represents all that is great about Midwest baseball, speaking as someone who's also from the Midwest. So really excited about that. And then the class, it's unique in terms of the experiences because you've got first-timers, CeCe, and Ichiro, who were briefly teammates in New York, which is interesting. And then you've got Billy Wagner, who made it in his final year, a graduate of a Division III college, Ferrum College in Virginia, someone who was naturally right-handed but then learned how to throw left-handed because he broke his arm playing high school football, which is or grade school football, which is an amazing story to think about a non-natural left-hander being the only left-handed closer ever to make it now is just something really miraculous, I think you would call it. And then for both Dave Parker and Dick Allen to be honored posthumously, I will admit, as much as I've covered the game, I did not fully have an appreciation for the historical place of Dick Allen until the last year.
Yeah.
Read a really beautiful memoir and a really raw and honest memoir that he wrote years ago about his journey and the racial discrimination that he faced. He's the first African-American professional baseball player in the state of Arkansas. He grew up in Pennsylvania, so he wasn't familiar really with the racial climate he was going to find in Little Rock when he went there. And actually, it was the segregationist governor who threw out the ceremonial first pitch, if you could believe that, of his first ever game there. So that was his experience. He's going there as the first black player, and you have a segregationist governor throwing out the first pitch. The message there, the way he was treated, it's remarkable what he was still able to achieve. And then Dave Parker, one of the defining players of the 1970s and the 80s, someone who was a beloved player really everywhere that he went. And I think we'll still be seeing that replay of the throw in the 79 All-Star game for the rest of time. It was funny. I spoke with Brian Downing, who was thrown out on that play a couple weeks ago. And I said, hey, I'd like to ask you about the throw. He said, oh, what throw? Like, he was teasing me, of course, because he knows that it's part of baseball lore. So just a really diverse class of players that can speak to different parts of the baseball experience.
Have a great time with all that, John. That'll be awesome. John Morosi joining us from the MLB Network. Trade deadline coming up. We keep hearing reports, Stephen Kwan untouchable. We keep seeing reports, Stephen Kwan likely to be traded. John, if you're the Guardians, why would you trade Stephen Kwan when he has two more years of team control out of this?
Well, I think you'd have to be overwhelmed, and I'll probably give you the same answer on Emmanuel Clase A. We'll give you the same answer on Cade Smith. It's interesting, though, because as you know from following the standings, it appears for all the world that the Tigers will not win another game this entire season. So if that's the case, maybe you don't trade anybody and you just let this thing play out. But in all fairness, the race has changed a little bit. It's now plausible. I mean, it's eight games is still eight games, but the Tigers really seem to be in a bad way right now. And I think you have to take all of that into consideration if you're the Guardians. I do believe they're still having some selling conversations, and if someone's going to overwhelm you for Class A in particular, I think you listen. And I would say with respect to Class A, the right teams are involved, meaning teams with deep position player-focused farm systems such as the Cubs and the Phillies, they need a late-inning reliever like him. And I think those are two teams that are going to be aggressive. So I subscribe to the theory, guys, that usually when it comes to relievers, especially those who are controllable, their value is never higher than it is right now at the trade deadline. I think with position players, you can usually take it into the off season if you want to. And so that's for that reason, I would say, while I'm not going to come out here and say that either trade is likely, I do think that Class A is likelier to be moved than Kwan. And I think ultimately it just comes down to a very clear-eyed position of what the Guardians are now and always have been, which is they realize their market size, and if someone's going to overwhelm them, they'll listen. And I think that's been the way that they've done business for a very, very long time.
You know, John, 2 years ago, they were in a very similar spot, right? Kind of hovering around 500, and they decide to move Savale and Bell and Rosario, and those moves did not play well in the clubhouse or with the fan base. The team ended up kind of collapsing down the stretch. Do you think the last week or so is kind of, you know, to your point, in terms of being a buyer or a seller, do you think the way the team has played over the last 14 games has kind of changed the way they view this season and maybe beyond?
I think it has to some at least incremental standpoint. And to be honest, it should. There are three games out of a wild card spot. And while, again, you'd have to pass three teams to move into a playoff position, and I'm someone who thinks the Red Sox will buy and are playing really good baseball. I mean, they're really the team that I would sort of set as my mark moving forward if I was the Guardians. Can we be X number of games better than Boston over the balance of the year? I mean, in my most honest assessment, if I was looking at it very objectively, I do not think the Guardians are going to be four games better than the Red Sox over the balance of the season. They're three games back right now. And the Rangers are playing better baseball right in front of them. So I think it feels like a less than 50-50 chance of making the playoffs if you just keep playing it out. And this is where you've got to play the percentages. It's, you know, that team, you think about the Guardians that you're referring to a couple of years ago, that was the year when the Rangers went to the World Series and it was a very wide open American League. Honestly, it's the same way right now. While I'm saying that there are teams that I frankly like better than the Guardians, this is not a league in which there's a single dominant, clear, obvious juggernaut team, even like the Yankees were a year ago. The Yankees that beat the Guardians last year don't exist anymore. It's a very, very different team. And so I do think that the somewhat up for grabs nature of the American League might play into the decision to at least, even if you don't sell, see the wisdom in holding, because again, are the Tigers really going to be a dominant team for the next 2 to 3 years? They've only got 1 year left of Scooble. And if they get off to a bad start next year, we're going to be talking about Tarik Skubal this time next year. So I think, especially given the amount of control you've got on Kwan and Class A, I still think you let this thing play out unless someone comes up and overwhelms you because of the way the Guardians have played the last couple weeks.
John, if somebody overwhelms them, and you know they play great ball after losing 10 straight, if somebody overwhelms them, can they thread the needle and trade one of those guys while still taking a real run at this thing?
Yes, they can. They can certainly still remain competitive. And what I do want to push back against a little bit is what I've heard across the industry as the recency bias of the Tigers last year. That is not normal to trade Flaherty and then still make the playoffs. And honestly, they're within one David Fry swing away from beating the Guardians in the division series. That's not something you can expect, everybody in baseball. Okay, this was like the first time ever that a team that had like a below 1% chance of making the playoffs in the middle of August went on to make the playoffs. That cannot be expected. Now, can you still stay in the race? Yes, you can still stay in the race, especially in this modern wild card situation with the three wild cards. You can completely still have relevant games down the stretch. And I think that's probably, and I empathize with the way that Guardians fans feel about this because, you know, last year's ALCS, it wasn't close in the end, but it was competitive.
Sure.
And if you got a little bit better bullpen performances and if Stanton and Soto weren't red hot at the time, maybe it's a different outcome. And so I think that the Guardians fans are justified in saying, hey, we just bought playoff tickets last year. We're not that bad right now. We're kind of right around 500, exactly 500 at 51-51. Let's just play this thing out a little bit. And honestly, I think that's probably a fair way to do it. The one thing that I would say that stands out to me is let's also not forget the lessons of that 10-game losing streak, which were offensively when Ramirez isn't going, and that was right after, as Guardians fans remember well, it was not long after he got hit by the pitch and he wasn't quite the same for a couple weeks. That reminded basically everybody that they do not have the lineup depth to be a formidable team unless Jose and to some lesser extent Kwan are rolling at the same time. If those two guys are either hurt or not feeling it for a particular window, they're just not a team that other clubs really worry about. I mean, that's just that's being honest. That's what that 10-day stretch told us. And so I do think if you could trade a reliever and get back two guys that you believe are going to be legitimate frontline position players for you within the next couple of years, if you can basically bring in the next version of Michael Brantley, which I still think, you know, as much as it was painful for the Indians at the time to trade CC, Brantley was a great player for them for a long time. That was a good trade. And I think that's, you know, is Owen Casey from the Cubs that kind of a player? Is Justin Crawford from the Phillies that kind of a player? We'll see. I don't know, but those are the kind of guys where if the Guardians' assessment is that they are difference-making position players, at least as good as Manzardo and probably better, then that's the kind of trade that you do have to at least think about if it addresses what I think I still believe are some fairly real lineup questions going forward.
John, a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing what happens. Always great insight. Thanks, bud.
Thank you so much, Jeff and Tom. I really appreciate it. All the best to everybody there in Cleveland, and enjoy this really special Hall of Fame weekend for both Tom and CeCe. It's going to be a lot of fun to cover it.
Absolutely.
Thanks, John
Morosi, MLB Network, MLB.com. He is all over everything going on in Cooperstown and, of course, the trade deadline.
1 hour to go. Nick Wilson, Jonathan Peterlin. We have had a day full of football talk. However, afternoon drive acknowledges the Cleveland Guardians. It's been a pretty good little stretch here. So we head out to the fan hotline to welcome in of Apple TV Plus, the Guardians Royals tomorrow night on Apple TV Plus with a 8:10 first pitch. Trisha Whitaker joins us. Trisha, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you here. Obviously, I think we've had you on each year that Apple TV Plus has been doing these games. And so this is the best part of the season to be doing this, Trisha, because the Guardians have gone from one end of the hot cycle to the other here. So I'll just ask you, the 10-game losing streak or this ride they've been on recently, which do you think is closer to the real Guardians?
Hell yeah, I love it. I love when a team proves who they are. you know, later in the season. I think these are the real Guardians that you're watching right now. That 10-game losing streak, not fun. It sucks, but it happens. I think they're showing who they are, winning 11 of their last 13, trimming that deficit in the Central from, what was it, guys, 15 and a half to 8 games in that span or something like that? I mean, that's insane. And they're looking for that 4-game sweep at the Orioles tonight. I just think that this is who the Guardians are, and I love it because every time I've been to Cleveland or covered the Guardians, I love their fan base, and I have a soft spot in my heart for them because I'm a Midwest girl. I was raised in Indiana. I tell you guys this a lot, I think, but I'm used to seeing Cleveland fans kind of suffer a little bit. So whenever the Guardians or the Browns or whoever it is, whenever they're good, I like to see it. So I think this, what we have seen in this span, these are the real Guardians, and this is the time to get hot. So fans should be excited about this stretch.
Well, and within that, Tricia, we're not kind of torn. You know, for a couple weeks, we were just talking about trading Class A, trading Kwan, trading Cade Smith, trading basically everyone that isn't Jose Ramirez. And now that you're back in the race, it feels like maybe we shouldn't be doing those things. What do you think the Guardians should be doing? Should we be selling? Should we be buying as the deadline approaches?
Well, you know, I think the talk has been around them getting a bat at the deadline. You know, they have the pieces to offer if that's what they want. Their deadline need is a righty bat. And so I think it's hard to tell, you know, because you heard the Guardians GM Mike Chernoff say the other day, you know, that it's been an emotional 2.5 weeks with the ups and downs of their season, and they're going to have to take it up to the last minute to see where they are. So I don't know. That's a really, really good question. Perhaps why I'm not paid the big dollars in MLB to make those decisions. But you do know that they do have that need for a righty bat if they could get one. We know they have the pieces to offer. You hope, you know, that they could keep some of the core of this team together, you know, and not do anything too drastic. But I don't know. We'll see, guys. I mean, sometimes we try to predict these things and we're completely off base, but I think we all know the need there. It's just a matter of whether or not they're going to pull the trigger.
Trisha, it's been such an interesting season. The AL Central at one point looked like a juggernaut. Now the Guardians are only one of two teams above 500, and they're right at 500. Oh, and then you got the NL, which we thought was going to be a powerhouse. The Dodgers struggling, the Braves struggling. It's just been such an interesting year. Is this as wide open across baseball, both leagues, for the race for playoffs and title that you can remember?
Yeah, I think in some ways. Obviously, you know, you look at the AL Central and the Tigers are just playing out of their mind right now. Well, I mean, obviously every team has tough stretches. But overall, when you look at what they've done specifically in the Guardians division, it's been wildly impressive. They've improved to everybody that last year, you know, wasn't a fluke. But then you do look at the other divisions, specifically in the AL. You look at the AL East. The Rays were flirting with the top for a while, but they have plummeted. But then you look at the Blue Jays, the Yankees, and even the Red Sox, and that's going to be an incredibly tight and exciting race to watch. The AL West is going to be fun as well, with the Mariners right there with the Astros. And then, obviously, you know, with the NL, the Mets and the Phillies are flirting with that top spot. And the NL Central is a pretty exciting division, too, right now. But you're right. I do think that we are looking at a really fun year in baseball where the gap between the top two or even the top three teams in these divisions is not very big. And that is so good for baseball. And I love to see it because it is horrible for baseball the way that the Rockies and the Pirates are performing this season. And the Nationals, I'll put them in that category. It's I hate it when that happens. And I wish that there was something that we could do with baseball, the schedule and whatnot to fix that, because it's just a waste of time and a waste of talent. But you're right. The divisions are really exciting this year right there at the top.
Yeah, it's interesting that you kind of point that out. Like in the AL, for instance, I mean, it's the A's and the White Sox. Orioles didn't plan to be there, so I kind of give them a pass. Like, they're legitimately trying. It just kind of didn't work out for them the way that they intended. But the A's and the White Sox, and the A's even had stretches where they looked somewhat competitive this year. Like in the American League, it seems like we have, for the first time in a while, and really maybe it's going back a couple years now, just a lot of contending teams and not many teams throwing in the towel, which has to be good.
No, you're exactly right, because it's just silly to sit there and watch a team such as the White Sox and the Rockies and just totally plummet. And you're right, I do give the Orioles a bit of a pass. It's not like they don't have good pieces. It's not like they're not trying. It's disappointing to see because I really like that team. I like the guys on that team a lot, and it's really been sad to see. If I'm being completely honest, what happened with Brandon Hyde was sad to see. What happened with Derek Shelton was sad to see because that wasn't his fault with the Pirates. It just wasn't. So anyways, you know, you talk about that theme around Major League Baseball right now. And yeah, you know, I would agree with you that it is a good thing to see that at the top of each division.
Trisha Whitaker on the fan hotline here. She'll be on the coverage of Apple TV Plus's Guardians-Royals game Friday night, 8 o'clock hour. First pitch here is the game's going to be live from Kansas City. Jose Ramirez is on one here recently, and it obviously coincides with a huge offensive outburst. And we're talking about a guy who was a fringe prospect who's now become one of the most beloved Guardians at 32. We are 100 games into the season. He's got a four war, almost batting 300, 21 home runs. I'm like, when you watch Hosey, we know what he means to us. Like, what to you stands out about Hosey?
Unbelievable. And I think, honestly, we were talking about this on our production call. It's just not fair how kind of, I guess you could say, under acknowledged he is. Everybody knows how good he is. But no player has had more top five MVP finishes than Jose Ramirez since 2017, but he didn't win any of those years. And you look at this year and you worry that might happen again with guys like Aaron Judge and Cal Raleigh being the two favorites to win this season. And it's a shame because, I mean, this is a guy we're talking, he's a future Hall of Famer. And I know third base is the most underrepresented position in the Hall of Fame, but he's a surefire to join that list at some point. And he's only gotten better with age, you know, and you would love to see him really in those MVP talks this year. I mean, I know he always is in the talks, but you know what I mean. It's just, you want to see him get that acknowledgement that he deserves.
Yeah, Trisha, you got to push for it, because I imagine in your production meeting, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, did you guys talk more about Bobby Witt or more about Jose Ramirez?
You know the answer to that. We talked more about Jose Ramirez, as we should have, and that's no slight to Bobby Witt Jr. Bobby Witt Jr. is an incredible player. He's, you know, one of the young players you look forward to watching in the future, and he's also just a phenomenal guy. But Jose Ramirez is going to be a Hall of Famer. He's 32 years old. He doesn't look like it. He's aging like a fine wine. And, you know, that's why we talked more about him. He's my pregame interview tomorrow, and I'm excited to chat with him. But he's just one of the all-time players.
You mentioned early in the interview, Trisha, the ground the Guardians have made up in both the Central Division and the Wild Card. If roughly 60-some games from now, we're talking about the Guardians in the playoffs, what will that be owed to?
Gosh, that'll be owed to, well, you know, I hate to sound like a broken record. You know what, you guys, I'm about to try something really cool. I'm on the phone with you. I'm going to see if my boarding pass will scan while I'm doing a live radio interview. This is going to be fun. But I think that'll be owed to, a lot of it'll be owed to Jose Ramirez and the leadership of Stephen Vogt. I mean, what he's been able to do, that's not an easy, those are not easy shoes to fill, to take over for a legend like Terry Francona. But he's been able to do it. So I think that's what it's going to be owed to, some of that veteran leadership, and hopefully the offense getting going like we know they can, like we hope they can, and perhaps maybe a move at the trade deadline. You never know. That's my guess, and I hope to see the Guardians in the postseason.
Gavin Williams versus Michael Wacha, the pitching matchup in the game for you guys tomorrow night. What's the discussion been like around this matchup? For us here, I can only speak to Williams. I can't speak much to Wacha, but it's been a little bit of a struggle relative to what some of the expectations were for such a large talent and the stuff that he does possess.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. I think, are you referring to Wacha there?
No, I'm referring to Williams, but it works for Wacha too.
Referring to Williams. Okay, yeah, sorry. You know, I'm trying to scan my boarding pass right now, and we'll see if it works. Hold on. Give me 2 seconds.
You
okay.
Got it.
Okay. It didn't work, you guys. This is the first radio interview I've ever done. Tried to scan my... There we go. It worked.
There we go.
I don't even know what you asked. I'm not even going to lie to you. Scanning a boarding pass and doing a live radio interview is not for the faint of hearted. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, I can. No, I can repeat it again. I was setting up the pitching matchup for tomorrow with Gavin Williams versus Michael Wacha, and I was explaining or just kind of weighing out how we see Gavin Williams here. Just a bunch of talent, just so many good pitches, but maybe the season hasn't come together as nicely as we would have all thought.
Yeah, it possibly hasn't, but he's coming off a good performance, if I'm not mistaken, on Sunday in their win over the Athletics, if I'm correct there. And that's encouraging to see, right? He was efficient. He fanned a season high
11 batters, his first double-digit strikeout game. And so when you look at a performance like that, that does encourage you moving forward. But certainly tomorrow is going to be a good test for him. And then down the stretch this season, you know, as things really get real for this Guardians team and they continue to make that postseason push, you're going to see what he's made of. I will not lie, I have not watched him enough to be able to give you guys a totally accurate analysis of him, but I'm certainly looking forward to it tomorrow night.
All right, I know Indiana has a history of being a basketball school, but after making the playoffs and Cignetti is hard charging into the season, is Indiana a football school officially?
You know the answer to that. Come on, hell yeah they are. Did you see what Kurt Cignetti said at Media Day the other day? It was amazing. We totally called out the SEC and their scheduling. That man is not scared of anything, and that's what we love to see, because IU has not had a coach like that. And we've especially not had a coach like that who's able to back up some of their smack talk, you know. Yesterday he said, we figured we'd adopt on the SEC scheduling philosophy. And I love that. He's not afraid to say what he thinks. And what he did last year at Big Ten Media Day was set the expectations high. And we all listened to him, and he was like, I win. That's what I do. Google me. And we're like, you're insane. You're playing it. You're coaching in Indiana. You know, we are terrible. We tend to take head coaches and ruin them because we have such terrible talent. Well, he backed that up with an incredible season. I'm a season ticket holder, so this has just been a fever dream to me. When I was a student, you guys, I covered Indiana football. It was my first sports reporting assignment ever. I covered them when they went 1-11, and somehow I still stayed in the field. So seeing them do what they've done recently has been amazing.
Yeah, we covered the 0-17 or 0-16 Browns. We definitely know how that is. All right, real quick, before we let you go, the Browns could have the number one pick next year. IU's got a new quarterback, Fernando Mendoza. Any inside skinny you can share with us?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I can share much with you guys. I just know that I have to check which seat I am on this plane, you guys. This is the most hilarious interview I've ever done while I'm boarding a plane on live radio. Fernando Mendoza, I certainly high expectations for him. And he got a lot of praise at Big Ten Media Day, so you'll love to see that. And as you guys know, I'm a sucker for the Browns and everything Cleveland, so I'm hoping they have a good season, too. That's all I got for you. I'm putting my suitcase up in the carry-on bin while I'm doing this interview.
Trisha, you're an all-time pro. We appreciate your time. Enjoy your flight, and we can't wait to see you on Apple TV Plus coverage for the Gardos Royals tomorrow, and we know you'll do a great job.
Hey, I can't wait to see you guys, too. I got my seat wrong while I was on the phone with you, but otherwise I did pretty well boarding a plane during a live interview.
That was pretty much Jonathan's fault. I think we all agree on that. Trisha, be good.
You guys too. We'll see you later.
Trisha Whitaker on the fan hotline there again. Guardians Royals on Apple TV Plus tomorrow, 8:10 first pitch. We'll react to what she had to say about the Gardos and maybe, probably not Indiana football. In 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Back with you on The Fan, it's Daryl Ryder, Danny Cunningham in for the boys. Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima. They will be back with you next week. Of course, Browns training camp kicking off today out in Berea. Fans, first practice will be on Friday at 2 p.m. But let's not forget about the Cleveland Guardians. They have flipped the script on all of us from going straight down the elevator shaft via a 10-game losing streak in which, while collecting three hits in a game, let alone hoping they could score three runs in a game, was a thing. Now they're back to scoring runs. They're pitching well. They're beating up on the teams that they're supposed to be beating up on. They're back to .500, having won 10 of 12. And how much does that change their thought process heading to the trade deadline? Let's welcome in the fantastic, outstanding writer for The Athletic, who covers the Cleveland Guardians in Major League Baseball. He is Zach Meisel. Zach, good morning. I know you're fired up, most importantly, for Browns training camp today.
I am, Daryl. We got four quarterbacks to talk about. I mean, we've never had this much content.
We did our quarterback rankings earlier in the show.
Yes, give us yours, Zach.
So let's go ahead and throw you just right into the fire, right out of the gate. Why don't you go ahead and rank these four arms?
All right. So one, Connor Shaw. Two, Bruce Gretkowski. 3, Spurgeon Win, and 4, Thad Lewitt.
Yes! See, I thought Thad would have been 3 at least.
I mean, I was kind of hoping for the guys that are actually still on the team, but I'll take that. That's a pretty good ranking.
I like to live in Zach's world. I think that's more fun.
Hey, Zach, times are good now for the Guardians. Steven Vogt talked after the game about just, you know, how much he loves where this ball club is at. They've got 62 games left, 50 up, 50 down. Ironically, 24-24 at home, and they're 26-26 on the road. How much has them being able to turn this thing back around, do you think, changed their thought process, their approach when it comes to adding or subtracting to this ball club by the trade deadline?
Yeah, you know, this is what Major League Baseball wants. This is why, you know, they have 3 wild cards in each league now. So the Guardians, who are sitting at 500, they're only 2.5 games back of a wild card spot. And look, there are a bunch of other teams kind of in that purgatory, in that middle ground in the American League. And so what it does is it just jams up the trade deadline, right? Like, we're 8 days away, but it would not surprise me at all if 99% of the activity took place within the final 24 hours or so of the deadline. And so I think that's where the Guardians are too, where, you know, that it's funny because the team said the week before the All-Star break, when they went to Houston and swept the Astros, they took 3 of 4 in Chicago. They said, look, we want this to be the week that we look back on and say, that's when we turned our season around. And the front office was sitting there saying, well, that's going to need to be the case. You know, they've definitely got an easier schedule here coming out of the break and even in August. And so they were hopeful that they'd play better and that would help make the decisions for them. And that has happened so far. So, you know, a lot of teams have been calling about Stephen Kwan and Emmanuel Clase and Cade Smith, and they've been calling since, and especially when the Guardians were losing 10 in a row, they're all thinking, oh my God, all these guys could be on the table. And I think the Guardians were quick to say, well, not so fast. You know, we need to see some more. And I think this is why.
Zach, how should the record that the Guardians have against teams that are above 500 versus the record they have against teams below 500 influence the way we look at who this team actually is as they sit at exactly 500?
Yeah, I mean, it's still important. Like, give them credit. They've played really well lately. The starting pitching's been so consistent that the offense has been better. You're seeing some nice, you know, you're finally seeing, like, Angel Martinez looks like someone that could help you now and in the future. Kyle Manzardo looks like someone who can help you now and in the future. Brian Rocchio has been really good lately. Those are all good things. The lineup is still not good enough. The rotation has questions. You know, maybe Shane Bieber can help answer those. The bullpen, like, half of it is really good and half of it is a mess, right? Like, this team still is, you know, they've had to fight and scrap and claw to get back just to 500. So I think you have to have a sense of reality here. Like, you know, this team is, would you pick them in a series against some other teams? Like, maybe not. But the front office is always thinking about the future, and sometimes even, you know, at the expense of the present. And so they're going to operate thinking just as much about 2026 as they are 2025. So, you know, I think that makes it so that a lot is still on the table. We've seen them, like, they were in the same exact position 2 years ago, right? And they were thinking more about the future than the present that year. So I think everything's still on the table, and they're going to take this down to the last minute.
Zach Meisel, the outstanding Guardians and Major League Baseball writer for The Athletic, joining us on the Fan Hotline. Zach, outside of Stephen Kwan, Jose Ramirez, over under number of guys that are going to finish the season with a batting average above 230.
I think Martinez will. And thanks for having me, guys. That's all I got.
I mean, you know, to your point, you know, this lineup has so many deficiencies from an offensive standpoint, Zach. You know, and you mentioned about how this front office, you know, tries to thread the needle between having one eye on today, but also having an eye on tomorrow. Do you see a situation where something could fall into place for them in the next couple of weeks where they can pull off a trade that might hurt them short term, but could set them up long term to fix a lot of these lineup deficiencies that they have?
Yeah, I mean, so Class A is the one. You know, that's the one, if you look at, like, I know the Mets would love to get their hands on a Cleveland reliever. I know the Phillies would love to get their hands on a Cleveland reliever. And there are a lot of other teams, too. So, it's not impossible. I really think, and, like, this changes day to day, but, like, I do think the way things are trending, like, it could be a quiet deadline for Cleveland. You know, I think there are, you could talk me into a Carlos Santana trade just so you can open up first base for CJ Kapis, open up at bats for Chase DeLauder if he ever gets healthy. But, like, you know, are you going to trade Steven Kwan right now? I don't think so. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. I think they're really hesitant to even move Class A at this point just because they've gotten themselves into a position where I think they kind of just want to see what might happen for the last 2 months. And Class A has 3.5 years of team control, so it's not like these offers wouldn't exist over the winter too. So That's sort of what they're weighing, you know, how much is going to change between now and December with some of their trade pieces. The problem with, like, they don't have any really attractive rentals, right? Like, they don't, like,
yeah,
they're not going to get anything for Carlos Santana or Lane Thomas or Paul Sewald, right? So they're kind of just stuck in the middle. It's like the only, you know, they certainly could trade prospects for help, but I also don't think that they feel like they're, you know, one rental bat away from winning the World Series here. So, you know, this is the problem. Like, it's great that they've gotten back to 500 and they've played better, but they dug themselves such a big hole. And more than anything, they just, it was the off season that they had. Like, they came into this season, but we've watched this same lineup night after night after night. And so now they're just kind of stuck with it.
So you said the thing that is most likely to happen, which is a quiet deadline for them. But if you were running the Guardians, what direction do you think you would go between buying, selling, or standing pat?
I would be doing everything with my mind looking toward 26. I think there are pieces in place to be a legit contender next year. Now, part of this is, like, I need to see CJ Kapis over the last 2 months. I need him to get his feet wet now so that next year you're not, like, coddling him, right? Like, think about Kyle Manzardo last season. He came up in May for a month. It was rough. He went back down, came back up late in the season, and in the playoffs he was hitting second. And so can you – you need to see what you have with Kapis. We'll probably learn Chase DeLauder's status today. If by some miracle he's healthy, same thing. Like, you got to see the kid. And, you know, other than that, there's just not a lot you can do. Like, Juan Brito has kind of been a lost season. You know, I'd love to see Travis Bazzana get up to AAA by the end of the year so that he can be in the conversation early next season. But I think you got to build around your two key pieces in the lineup. I think you need to build around the rotation, and I think you need to have a much different winter than you had last time.
You brought him up, so I want to ask about him now, but why have they been so hesitant to call up the kids in Chase DeLauder, who obviously now is dealing with yet another health issue, despite the fact that all of his healthy time has been spent in AAA as opposed to the major leagues, and CJ Kapis? Like, what is it about this front office that is so hesitant to bring up guys that very clearly to the outsider like me, Zach, look as if they're ready to be in the big leagues?
Yeah, they're just a... stubborn maybe is the word. I don't know. They set a plan and they stick to it. And the plan was to build up Chase DeLauder until he was playing, I think it was like five times a week, but 4 to 5 days in a row. And they preferred to do it in the minor leagues because, you know, if he didn't bounce back a certain day and he was sore, they could just sit him and it wouldn't screw up, you know, the major league plans for everybody else, right? Now, I'm saying that, and this is their plan, and they were going to stick to it until he completed the plan and then call him up. I'm with you. Just get the kid up to the major leagues, and if he gets hurt at the major leagues, he gets hurt at the major leagues, but at least you saw him and he can help you. And that's the issue I've had with this season, is that you came into this season already with a deficient lineup, and you've done nothing to fix it until this point. And that's why I'm just, you know, like, the offense has been better for the last 2 weeks, but it was so bad for like 3+ months that it's going to fall somewhere in between there. So I don't expect them to keep scoring 6, 7, 8 runs a night here. And now with the Lauder, a question, you know, you don't have a lot of, it's Kafis, and that's like it at AAA, who can help you and maybe give the offense a jolt right now. And so that's why they're just in this tough spot, because I just think their ceiling is a little low for the rest of this season.
Zach, saw your post that hit The Athletic this morning, your tribute to Hall of Fame broadcaster Tom Hamilton, who is going to receive the Ford Frick Award in Cooperstown. You know, I'm not just saying this because you're on with us right now. I think you are one of the premier writers when it comes to painting a picture and how you opened your story. Just beautifully fantastic. But take us through that story and what Tom Hamilton has meant to you personally and professionally as he gets inducted into baseball's hallowed hall.
Yeah, I mean, Daryl, you know this. Like, he is the most humble guy, and it's honestly difficult to write about him. And so I decided months ago, you know, I was not going to bother him at all. Like, I'd rather talk to other people about him. And so, you know, you talk to Hall of Fame broadcasters who have won the same award, and you listen to them talk about Tom Hamilton, and you start to realize, like, sometimes we get caught in our own bubble here in Cleveland, and look, we've been blessed, right? Like, we've had some of the absolute greatest calling our sports games here for long periods of time. Like, it's incredible, honestly. And Hammy is one of those, and it's incredible to realize that he's got that reputation among the best of the best outside of Cleveland. Like, it's hard for a baseball play-by-play person in another city to really grasp how good Tom Hamilton is at the job. Yeah. And yet so many of them, like, whether it's on their way home from their own games, whether it's in retirement, whether it's just looking on social media to find his home run calls, like, they're all aware. They all go out of their way to listen to that man. And so, you know, he's had a tough couple weeks here preparing his speech and losing sleep over it and being overwhelmed with whether it's interview requests or just people saying kind things about him. So, you know, it's going to be interesting Saturday when he's up there in Cooperstown giving his speech. And it's just crazy to think the guy who's been narrating everybody else's stories for so long and doing such an expert job at it has to relay his own story. And it's been something he's always uncomfortable with. So it's just, he's, you know, like, the best way I can put it is, whether you know him and you've talked to him and you've gotten sucked into those compelling conversations with him that you think are going to last 2 minutes and it turns into 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Or you just listen to him through your radio, like, you feel like he's talking directly to you and he cares about you and that he's your best friend. And so we're blessed to have him here. And it's, you know, I don't know how long he's going to do it, but, like, it would be so weird to imagine anybody else in that chair.
When you think of Tom Hamilton, what call do you think of?
That's a good question. So I will say I, in the story today, we embedded what I think are, like, the cream of the crop and what, players and coaches I talked to, what they said was their favorite calls. Everyone says the Tim Anderson, Jose Ramirez fight. That was the most popular answer. And of course, he says that his call was only good because he was lucky. He had the perfect angle from his booth. It's like, the guy, come on, give yourself some credit. But I think, I don't know, maybe the Rajay Davis one, just because that was such an unexpected home run, and the way he let it breathe, like, if you go back and listen, like, that's a hard one. It's not your typical, like, swing in a driveway back, like no doubt home run. Like, that thing snuck over the wall in left field, and then you're sitting there, like, I remember me being frozen trying to figure out, oh my god, like, what am I gonna write, what's gonna happen, what did that just happen? And for him to nail that call on the radio where you're not trying to be overbearing and dominate the moment and like listen to the atmosphere in that moment, like I just thought he nailed that. That one for sure stands out.
Mine, I'll give you mine, Zach. 1995, when they clinched the division, the season of dreams is a reality. Cleveland, you will have an October to remember. That one is one that I will remember for the rest of my life. He's our version of Ernie Harwell, Bob Uecker, Jack Buck, among the greats of the great. Zach, I love the piece that you wrote this morning. I thought it was a perfect tribute, and you're absolutely right. Tom is so humble. You walk by him in the press box, and a quick hello turns into 45 minutes later, you both realize you had to be somewhere else.
Exactly.
Zach, yeah, appreciate the time as always. You're the best, my friend.
You got to go. Take
Thank
care.
You. He is Zach Meisel, who writes for The Athletic, covers the Guardians, covers Major League Baseball. I encourage all of you to pop on the Athletic's website and read his Tom Hamilton piece. It might bring a tear or two to your eye.
There's one way to set the tone for Browns training camp, and that is to bring in a Hall of Famer, a Browns legend, a fan favorite. This man slings some beef these days. I mean that in a good way. It didn't come out the way I was hoping it would come out, but you can check out Hall of Fame Beef at sixspringsfarms.com. That's farm, not farms. Joe Thomas joins us on the fan hotline. Joe, welcome to the show, buddy.
Hey, Nick. How's it going, man? Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. It's all, like it really does now feel like camp has begun because you're here. We're talking with you where you're at with this team. So I guess we'll just start here. Coming off 3-14, where do you set your expectations for this Browns team?
Well, I think like anybody that follows the Browns, they know that it's going to kind of come down to quarterback play. We feel pretty good about the defense. I think we've improved our receiver room. I think our offensive line is solid again, maybe even a little better than last year. Running back, a little bit of a question mark, obviously, because of the Quinshon Judkins situation that he's dealing with right now. But if you get solid quarterback play, I think this is a team that can get into the playoffs, and if you get hot, they can make some noise. And so I think that's kind of where the focus should be. It's like, hey, we can be a pretty good team if we put some things together and we get some of the young guys stepping up. And we get some quality play from quarterback. We don't know who it's going to be for sure, but I would guess it's going to be Joe Flacco to start the season. So certainly all eyes are going to be on that quarterback position.
Joe, are you on your farm right now? Are you like on a tractor?
Well, it's kind of funny you said that because I almost missed the interview. I was on my skid loader. I was trying to hang a tree stand. You know, we're getting ready for the fall football season, deer season. And got in a real tight spot, down in a hole with the skid loader, no service. But I was able to bushwhack my way out of there and sprint through the bean field to just get in the truck and be able to get enough service to call my friends over here, which it would have been pretty sad. We've been talking about this interview for a couple weeks, Nick, so if I would have missed it, I would have been real sad.
Yeah, so it's so funny you said this, Joe. I was on my tractor on our property this weekend, and somebody called me, and I was like, oh, I got to pick up this call. Turned it off, forgot to set the brake, and I'm on the phone, and the tractor started going backwards towards the lake. And I ditched the tractor and that broke my face.
Oh, we don't want to break that face. I mean, how are you going to make your money?
That's true. It's the moneymaker. This is so true.
Yeah. So take a peek at my Instagram, Joe Thomas 73. As soon as I get more service to be able to add it up there on my Instagram reels, I put a little reel of where I am, which is in a real bad spot. So we're going to need a big tow truck, maybe even like a Chinook helicopter to pull me out of there.
All right, Joe, what kind of spot is Stefanski in with these quarterbacks? Have you ever seen a four quarterback competition?
That's a great question. If we had four at any point in my career, I'd believe you if you told me that, but I would also say we probably had none. So I think it's a little different situation than the times when we had a bounty of quarterbacks in our quarterback room, because I think there are some legitimate quarterbacks that could do some pretty good things this year. Obviously, everybody knows Joe Flacco and what he's done throughout his career, but there's been some pretty good early returns, I think, from Dylan Gabriel. The coaches have raved about how smart he is, how accurate he is. He's a playmaker throughout his career. I'm not saying that
you know, he's going to be the starter, but I think he's somebody that you definitely want to watch during training camp and preseason. And obviously we know about Shedeur Sanders and where he fell to the Browns. But also, like, there's a big unknown with Shedeur where he could really be the first guy. And I think they're set up right now with low pressure, which is huge for a young quarterback, to be able to go out and make plays and have an opportunity to play free. And I think that's the best situation for a young quarterback, whether Joe Flacco has it the entire season or whether at some point in the season he gives it up and we see one of those other guys. So I think the quarterback room probably doesn't have any guys that are going to make the Pro Bowl this year, but I think there's some quality players in there that can make some plays and that gives some pretty good interest and some hope for the team this year.
So you mentioned Shedeur, and it's been really interesting to watch, you know, where fans embrace him and where some fans maybe are still resistant, because he's a quarterback that has a huge social media following. That's a big part of what he does. How big of a deal, like in that locker room, how does a social media superstar meets quarterback? How does that fare in the locker room?
Well, I think that most of the guys in today's NFL and the Browns locker room are pretty comfortable with having celebrities on Instagram and social media. It might have been a little bit different when I was playing, because I mean, I really didn't even have social media. I mean, Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff came out when I was in the middle of my career. So I think maybe at that time, some of the older guys would have maybe looked down on him a little bit and said, oh, why don't you focus on football? But it's just so well accepted and so common and normal these days. And I think Shedeur gets maybe a little bit more flack than he should about his following, because it's not like he's doing crazy things and posting ridiculous Jake Paul videos, you know, just trying to be outrageous for clicks. I mean, he's just really famous because, one, his dad was one of the most flashy, famous, flamboyant NFL players of certainly our generation. And Shedeur had a very successful career. People were interested in him because of his dad. And then the success that he had throughout his college career. So I think he's very popular for a lot of reasons, but none of them are the reasons that maybe a Johnny Manziel is really popular, and that kind of leaves the Browns fans with some scars about quarterbacks that have this huge following coming into the league.
Are people being too hard on Kenny Pickett?
That's a good question. I guess not being in Cleveland, I don't get it every single day like you guys do, but I guess I'm not hearing that fans are too hard on him. I mean, he was a guy that didn't work out in Pittsburgh, and you pick him up because he's got some talent. You want to see, hey, you know, is he somebody that might still have something there? Maybe it wasn't the right situation. Maybe he didn't have the coaching that he needed in Pittsburgh. And so I don't think they're really counting on him for much, and they're hoping that, yeah, he could be a good player for us, but I don't think he's one of the guys that the team is counting on. So I don't think that he really has super high expectations within the building. But I could be wrong about that. I mean, I haven't been out there to watch him yet. I'll be out there the 1st of August watching training camp and working training camp. So I'm really excited to see all these guys and just kind of get my first impressions with my own eyes on a lot of these guys, obviously everybody but Joe Flacco.
I'll send you some clips of things I've said. Joe, what's more
okay,
important?
So it's Nick. Yeah. What you should have said is Nick being too critical.
Yes,
basically.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're saying. So what's more important to the locker room, a quick resolution to the quarterback derby or a thorough search?
I would say quick if you have to have one, because I think the quick answer would be Joe Flacco, because he's the known quantity, he's the guy that everybody's comfortable with. So if it was a quick decision, I think everybody's going to say, yep, he knows the offense, he can still sling the ball, he's going to put everybody in the right spot, he's going to make the right audibles, he's going to get us where we need to be so we can operate efficiently, and that individually all the players can focus on their job. Because the worst part about having a quarterback who's young and maybe inexperienced is now everybody's worrying about what he's doing, and then you're not thinking about what you have to do, which it's human nature to do that, but it's really a bad thing. And I think it causes a lot of distractions and disruption within the offense, within a team, when you don't know who that leader is, who's your quarterback. Because even if you're a wallflower, if you're the starting quarterback, you are the unquestioned leader of that team. And so guys want to know who they're supposed to look to
in times of trials and tribulation. So I think a quick resolution is the most important thing.
DeJuan Jones is down about roughly 60 to 70 pounds. He looks much skinnier than what he was last year, which I would imagine is going to be a good thing. But like from your perspective, how different is it playing with such a massive shift and losing all that weight and your body composition just being way different than what it was in previous years?
Well, it all depends on how he lost the weight. You know, if he committed himself to diet and nutrition and he was losing it slowly and maintaining his muscle mass, I think what you're going to see is still a mountain of a man, but with added quickness, mobility, probably going to be a little bit more resistant to injury. So I would say that is the best version of himself. He's going to feel great. He's going to be in great shape because throughout DeJuan's career, he's a big man. And being a big person, you get hot, especially in training camp, you get tired, and then you lose your technique, you lose your focus. And if he's feeling a difference in his conditioning, if he's feeling a difference where he's not getting tired, he can continue to focus on his technique, he's going to make leaps and bounds gains with his technique and with his performance now that he's over there at the left tackle spot.
Browns legend, Hall of Famer Joe Thomas on the fan hotline here with Nick and Jonathan, breaking down all the things we're talking about here with the Browns in training camp. One of the biggest storylines, and I was happy to hear it from the Browns, was the hiring of Mike Bloomgren, which is kind of taking them back to a very similar type offensive line blocking scheme that Bill Callahan ran that they had such success with. How big of an impact do you think that is for this team going back to that Callahan type blocking scheme?
Well, they've got a lot of the same guys that had a ton of success with that scheme, and I think it fits the quarterbacks that we have. Obviously, we tried to make that switch because we thought Deshaun Watson was your franchise quarterback. He was more comfortable in the shotgun. Shotgun's not as easy to run your play-action stuff out of. And so it was more of a college-type offense with the zone reads and the RPOs. But I think going back to what was their bread and butter, what Stefanski has always known, it's just a comfort factor. And I always thought that the best offensive coordinators that I had, and I had nine of them, so I had a lot to choose from, were the guys that created their own offense. Kyle Shanahan, right? Like, yeah, his dad started it, but he took what his dad did and he made his own offense. He made it his own. The guys that always struggle were the ones that said, okay, these are the players that I have, so I'm going to do this. And you're going to know the offense, but it's those little tweaks that you have to make every single week, those little special plays that you have to piggyback off of what you did earlier in the season with different formations that I think you lose. And it's the difference between, you know, somebody that is a professor that wrote the textbook, that knows everything there is about the subject, that can easily pivot and change and is creatively changing what they're doing every single time they're on the field, versus a guy that, you know, is probably a really smart professor, but he's just teaching off of somebody else's textbook, and he's not going to be able to be nimble when it comes to being able to adjust to the speed of the changes of scheme and technique that happens throughout the course of an NFL season. So I think it's going to be a huge change for the better, and I think it fits with not only the quarterback but also the linemen that we have. And you know, depending on what happens in the running back situation, though, I think having that power run game with the zone blocking and then getting some of those pin pull concepts where you can get your big guards out on the edge, I think that just fits who we are, and it sets up deep shots in the play action passing game. So I think it's a welcome change and reversion back to what Stefanski and most of the guys in the offense really are good at.
Colin Cowherd started a convo today, and it's kind of just been gaining steam all throughout the day about Nick Saban and Arch Manning to the Browns next year. And, I mean, obviously there's a lot of layers attached to that. We don't even know if Arch Manning is going to come out. But do you feel like Nick Saban, do you feel like he'd want to go back to the NFL and give that a go?
I got to believe that Nick Saban is smart enough to know that it's not as easy as just showing up in the NFL just because you're Nick Saban. I mean, he tried it once. And I think he learned that the NFL game is so different because you can't use recruiting as the enormous tool that he did when he was in college. He was certainly an amazing college coach, best college coach of all time, no doubt. But a big component of his success was he was able to get the best players in the country every single year. And in the NFL, you don't have that luxury. So I just don't see him going back to the NFL, although if he was going to go back to coaching, he's probably not going to do it in college because I think he despises the NIL stuff and doesn't want to have to deal with that either because, oh, ding, 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 he doesn't have the recruiting advantage he used to have anymore. Everybody's paying their players now.
Ooh, there's a little shot there about the SEC play. I like it. No, I really enjoy that. You know me, I'm petty, Joe, so we enjoy any of it. You know, Joel Bitonio announces he's coming back this year. He hasn't quite said it's going to be his last year, but it could be. You know, as Joel starts to figure out, you know, whether this is it or not, what advice do you have for him in knowing that this could be his last year in the NFL?
Well, I would tell him enjoy every single have, because when you're on the other side, you're going to wish you were still playing, no matter what the career was that you had. Like, there's nothing like going in that locker room with your brothers and celebrating a victory or crying together when you have a defeat, or the sweat, the blood that you put on that field during training camp and then coming back and just shooting the breeze in the locker room. And just the idea of only thinking months is something that you just don't get in civilian life. And it's really a joy to be able to be a professional player. I loved every second of it, even when I was miserable and I told everybody I hated my life. It was the worst thing ever because everything hurts and I can't do another two-a-day, but it's still way better than the alternative. And that's what I told Joel when we talked in the offseason. I said, hey, if you're feeling healthy enough, play as long as you can, because there's nothing else in the world that will give you as much satisfaction and pay you as well as the NFL. And once you cut that cord and it's over and there's no turning back. So if he's playing great and if he's feeling good, I hope he plays more than one. But I know as you get up there in the double digits, sometimes that body starts sparking back.
Joe, I thought it was really cool. Morgan Wallen wore your jersey, in Wisconsin, but it was the Badgers jersey, obviously. Do you have any confirmation that he'll wear a Joe Thomas jersey for when he plays in Cleveland in about a month's time?
Well, it was funny. I was listening to the whole Morgan Wallen soundtrack today when I was on my skid loader. It's something about being out in the farm and listening. So I'm hoping I'll be there, because I'm going to call the Philadelphia Eagles preseason game and fly back to Cleveland. So I think night two I'll be there. So I'm hoping to be there. I haven't heard anything from them, but hey, if your buddy's with Morgan, maybe you could put in a good word.
You got to be doing the walkout, I would imagine, at a minimum, if you're there.
That would be great. That would be a dream, but that's all I can say.
Here's what I'll tell you.
It's happening.
If you need moral support, Joe, JP and I will be there for you. If you want us to walk out with you, that could be an intimidating stage. We'll do that for you.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, guys. That's what good friends are for, right?
I mean, that's all we're here for, is to be good friends. So, obviously, we started talking about Hall of Fame beef at Six Springs Farm. How's farm life going, buddy?
It's going great, man. It is a really exciting time on the farm for Hall of Fame beef, because we've got our very first 100% Japanese Wagyu beef that's going to be available mid-August, right in the middle of training camp, getting ready for Labor Day. And I've had a few sneak peeks of it already. Cooked it for some friends that were in town from Germany out at the farm 2 weekends ago. And then Tyler Hubbard played at my Hall of Fame induction, and we became friends. So I saw him at his concert in Wisconsin last weekend, and he's like, hey man, I hear about your beef, can you bring some over? We'll cook it up before the show. So I brought some over, and needless to say, if you don't believe me, that's okay, but Tyler Hubbard says it's the best steak he's ever had in his life, so I trust that dude.
That is one hell of a write up there. Joe, you're always so gracious with your time, man. Thank you so much for giving us it, and cannot wait till we get to see you in Cleveland here in a couple weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on, guys. And go to my Instagram, JoeThomas73. I think I tagged you, Nick. As soon as that video comes up, you'll see where I was. And I got a fun Alice song on there. You'll appreciate it if you're a child of the 90s and you listen to any hard rock back in the day.
All right, we're giving it a go, buddy. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Joe Thomas there on the Fan Hotline. He was gone. The Fan Hotline. Great stuff with Joe. We'll react to what he had to say about the Browns quarterback situation and more in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
We're going to go on out to the Fan Hotline and bring in our next guest of the day. He was on just last week and he said some pretty, not controversial, but things that got people talking. We'll put it that way. And I had the pleasure of, not so long ago, parading the sidelines this time of year at St. John Fisher College with this gentleman, Tyler Dunn, Go Long TD, joining us on the show. Ty, always good to catch up, my friend. Football's in the air, man. It's such a fun time of year.
What is going on? What a pleasure to hear that voice, man. Love those times. On the sideline, right, standing there for 3-4 hours, you know, your back's going out. I always think about these coaches, too. They do a lot of standing.
and a lot of sitting. And they all kind of had just brutal back problems. So, you know, hat tip to all the chiropractors out there. But, yeah, that's where my mind went as you share that. You know what's funny, too? I don't even know what I'm saying is controversial. I don't even know what you're talking about. I guess I'm bullish on these Browns to an extent.
I walked back the controversial part. I don't think it was controversial. People in Cleveland loved to hear it. But I am curious, Ty, because
some.
Yeah, that's true. Some. But I am curious, Ty, because one of the things that you said was that you think the Browns are going to be better than expected. And I'm actually right there with you. Like, the Vegas win total, I think, is a little low. And I've been saying all along, like, if you can just get average offense off of what you had last year, why can't you win, like, even three more games than you did a year ago? But I guess I'm curious from your perspective, what does better than people are expecting look like? Like, could they be a fringe playoff team, or is that maybe dreaming a little too big?
Ooh, it's a brutal schedule. You know, start there. You look at September, October. If they can survive the first month and a half, and a lot of these young players can grow and figure out what they do well and have a role, you know, I don't think it's outlandish to think that Cleveland can at least hover around that in the hunt graphic by Thanksgiving. Maybe that's the goal, right? Let's show up in the hunt graphic. But
that's always,
you know,
more goal
than wins, right? More than wins, more than losses. I think it's a matter of how does it look. And I had the pleasure of chatting with Grant Delpit at length there in Berea. This would have been back in the spring, and we've got a story up at the site if folks want to check it out. But I just think it's a matter of, okay, you have a chance to kind of create a whole new world where, you know, maybe you have to deal with the contract of Deshaun Watson, but you're finally kind of looking at that light at the end of the tunnel and trying to remake this team while still maintaining a core of vets. And, you know, I think there might be some fans out there that look at this as, you know, being kind of half pregnant. Are you rebuilding? Are you trying to compete? I don't know, man. Like, talking to Joe Thomas, who lived the Hugh Jackson days, I think completely just gutting the roster and everything is what you do not want to do, right? You can't have that building reeking to that extent ever again. If you have a Hall of Fame talent, it behooves you to keep that Hall of Fame talent around. I love this defense. Myles Garrett, Delpit, Denzel Ward. There are some core pieces there, to your point, Spence. If they can get something out of the offense and not turn the ball over and not be just an utter disaster at the quarterback position, I see them winning some of these games at the end.
Ty, one of the other things that you said that I think raised a lot of eyebrows here in Cleveland was that
it's a better way to put it.
You think Kevin Stefanski is a top five coach, and that's not something that I personally want to push back on because I have been a bit of a Kevin Stefanski defender in this town. But what is it about him that you think makes him a top five coach in the NFL?
I think it's a matter of circumstance, too. And look, he's not completely blameless when it comes to the decision of handing $230 million guaranteed and the draft picks. I'd imagine he's a voice in the room to some extent. So this isn't just to completely, you know, exonerate him from what may be the worst trade in modern NFL history, if not NFL history. But look, he's won a lot of games with terrible, to put it nicely on radio, quarterback play. I mean, it blows my mind that the Browns have been able to get to the playoffs twice, have two very competitive contending teams in December with who they've had playing the quarterback position. And I thought that Joe Thomas put it really well, where he's one of the best at just scheming up big plays. Regardless of personnel, he can get a receiver open down the field in a big-time situation. Is that quarterback always hitting the receiver? No. But I think that this is a team that's dealt with some brutal injuries, some brutal quarterback play, and the fact that they've been able to win and be competitive for the most part says a lot about coaching. And when it comes to Stefanski, I'm kind of even thinking back to his Viking days, knowing some sources there in Minnesota. I mean, everybody speaks so highly of him. Players, coaches. This is who you want, I think, leading your team. I mean, I'm just surprised that, you know, there would be as much talk as there is on wanting to get rid of him. Now, look, if they go out there and, you know, none of these four guys show anything at the quarterback position and they go 3-14 again, maybe you're forced to do something. I get it. That pressure could be through the roof. I just don't see that happening. I see this team being competitive in games that people don't expect them to be competitive in. Look, the Steelers are going to take a step back. They're directionless. They're delusional. I mean, if you think you're going to compete for a Super Bowl with Aaron Rodgers at this stage of your career, I've got some, you know, real estate in Antarctica to sell you. They're not
ooh, enticing.
Good. I mean, I think Cleveland finishes ahead of Pittsburgh this year. I look at these two rosters, and I just like the Browns more. I like their coaching, you know, more, at least on the offensive side of the ball. And maybe this is the year once and for all that they're able to, you know, not overtake Pittsburgh. I mean, Pittsburgh has owned them, but maybe the pendulum starts to swing their direction a little bit. I think they actually have a plan at the quarterback position. If it might not look good now, you know, day to day, but I like throwing these darts at the board with all four of these guys and having some picks next year to take a stab at it then if none of them pan out.
So you mentioned having a plan at the quarterback position. What do you think the ideal year for the Browns at that spot looks like this year, given who is on their roster?
You know, I think ideally you'd love Joe Flacco to continue this magic carpet ride. I mean, he did win comeback player of the year over Damar Hamlin right here in Western New York where I live. It was fun. It was fun as hell. The YOLO balls and the big plays and just seeing him a little bit there during OTA's minicamp. I mean, he still has an arm. I mean, he could sling it. So I think their ideal world is, look, he's your quarterback. He stabilizes. The position is Joe Flacco earning a 7-year contract at his age? No, not exactly. But I think it's a matter of respectability and competing. And, yeah, that would be ideal. Deal, but I think also you'd love to maybe see something out of one of these rookies, whether it's Shador Sanders, you know, for a few games late in the season. Maybe similar to, you know, if we're talking ideal world, right? I'm not saying this is going to happen, but ideally Flacco keeps you competitive. I mean, you're hanging in that playoff hunt for a while, and maybe if you're out of it by the end of the season, you get a little 3-game cameo out of one of your rookies, and he balls out, and you're really excited about him in the future, right? He plays Shador Sanders or Dylan Gabriel at that point, and he looks like Michael Penix did for Atlanta at the end of the season. I don't know if that's going to happen. I just love that they're keeping their options open, that maybe it's one of these guys. Hell, maybe Kenny Pickett has himself a Sam Darnold resurgence. You're going to have that ammo next year in what should be a better class of quarterbacks. I think that's the big thing, too, is, you know, kind of targeting a year ahead of time for one of these prospects and not getting stuck like those Steelers. I mean, they backed themselves into a corner for a quarterback in a historically putrid class. By the time they moved on from Ben Roethlisberger, and they should have moved on a year or two ahead of time, they forced themselves to draft, you know, Kenny Pickett. And, you know, I like Pickett a lot. And it was a terrible situation there. I mean, Matt Canada was the worst play caller in the sport. The line was a joke. They did no favors for Kenny Pickett. I wouldn't be surprised if he did something there in Cleveland. But there was just no plan. I mean, by the time you're drafting a guy, you're overdrafting him a little bit. Buffalo did the same thing with E.J. Manuel in 2013 here. And then you're setting yourself back a year, 2 years, 3 years. I think Cleveland's doing a good job of kind of forecasting the market at the position and thinking 2, 3, 4 moves ahead of time. The key is to keep your jobs, though, right? Like, you got to be competitive. You got to sell to ownership that you have a plan and that you have a team that is going to fill seats in the new stadium. So that's kind of the balance that I think Andrew Berry and Kevin Stefanski are tightroping here.
Tyler Dunn joining us on the show, of course, writes for his own personal site, golongtd.com. And this isn't hyperbole when I say this. Like, Ty is, to me, one of the best, like, feature story investigative writers in this business, man. Like, he's awesome. If you haven't subscribed, please do. He's got that story about Grant Delpit he mentioned. You want to check it out. It's really well done. Ty, you've been part of numerous quarterback competitions there in Buffalo over the years, watching that sort of play out. So you know how these things tend to go. When do you think the Browns need to sort of know who their starting quarterback is, or at least internally indicate to the team who their starting quarterback is throughout the next month or so?
You have to think they've got a really strong idea right now. It's not like they're just rolling a ball out onto the field, you know, late July and, hey, that best man wins and everybody has the same exact shot to win this. They got to have an idea. It's probably like you're kind of looking at two mini battles here between Flacco and Pickett as the vets, Gabriel and Shador as the rookies, maybe competing to be that young guy in waiting if the season falls apart and maybe you want to see what one of them look like. But I would think a week or two, right? Like, you don't want this thing to drag on and on and on, and the Browns have even spoken to that effect on wanting to get some answers, right? You don't want to rush it, but you want one of these guys to blow you away. And I'm trying to think of a comp because the Bills have definitely been through it. You know, at 2015 with Rex, you know, they didn't have much of a plan at quarterback and it kind of backfired. But they went in thinking Matt Castle was going to be their starting quarterback. That's who Greg Roman, the OC, wanted. But Rex loved Tyrod Taylor. And then they had E.J. Manuel kind of hanging around. And, you know, E.J. never really had a shot. They told everybody that he did, but he wasn't getting the reps, and you could see it. So that's kind of the problem here too, right? Like the new CBA, it's not like you have an abundance of practices and reps, 11-on-11 work, for everybody to get the same amount and to really see. So you do kind of have to pick and choose your battles. And eventually Tyrod just made a few more plays to Matt Cass. It was clear that he gave you the best chance to win. So what's that moment for the Browns? Maybe it is that first exhibition game. Maybe you see something like the Bills did in a Tyrod Taylor where, you know, somebody blows you away and you just go that direction. So I don't think they're going to want to, you know, kind of tiptoe around this thing, yeah, and let it drag on and on. You got to have your team rallying behind somebody week one.
Ty, I've got a couple more here for you. One more overarching AFC question. But before we get to that, we have teased the Grant Delpit article. I just want to get a sense of, you know, as you talked to Grant, as you worked on this piece, what did you glean from your conversations with him? Just what did you learn maybe about him as a player and as a person?
You know, I think you have to go back to the last game of the season where the Cleveland Browns had nothing to play for. You know, you're facing a Baltimore team that had everything to play for. And Grant was the one inside that locker room who looked everybody in the eyes and said, "We're going to find out who's riding with us in 2025.
Yeah.
Like, basically, like, if you're not going to work, if you're not going to, you know, pour your blood, sweat, and tears into this thing, like, get the hell out of here. You know, you're not a part of this." And they go out, and Grant made some plays. The last couple games, his coach told me this. He's like, "Go back and watch those games. He's playing hard, and you can see those moments out of Grant Delpit." But you didn't see those moments out of a lot of these players, and a lot of those other players are gone. They turned over the roster, and I think that's the key in talking to a source in that Browns front office. They want to find players who are like Grant Delpit, players who are going to get socked in the jaw and know how to respond to adversity. How often did you see last season the Browns players just kind of roll over and die? I mean, they were outscored by 177 points last season, which is even a lot by Browns measures. So they've got to figure out a way to rewire the DNA of this team, and that's kind of the whole point of the story is Grant Delpit is the one that wants to be the voice for everybody to follow. Now, Myles Garrett's unbelievably talented, not necessarily like an A-plus leader. Like, you know, he's going to lead by his action. They need somebody in the locker room who's going to speak up and kind of take the bull by the horns, and Delpit realizes it's got to be him. And, you know, I look back at those LSU days and chatted with Bill Bush, his coach with the Tigers. You can kind of look at that cutthroat world in Baton Rouge to get a sense for maybe what the Cleveland Browns are trying to create. It was a different world, hitting drills. And I mean, it was like Junction Boys stuff at times. So yeah, a lot of fun trying to figure out what kind of world the Cleveland Browns can create. I think that's what's exciting about this team. They can create a whole new world, right? Everybody's excited this time of year, but I think with Cleveland, it's got to feel like maybe a weight's lifted off the shoulder to a degree where, all right, now we can actually try to build this thing long-term. We're not kidding ourselves anymore.
How much does that leadership aspect of things matter inside an NFL locker room?
I think it matters a hell of a lot because, I don't know, like I've never viewed football through a mathematical equation like baseball. You know, even you know, there's so many X and O's, junkies and gurus, and you pull up Twitter and it's like everybody's a film expert. Look, like, football is it's the ultimate violent physical team sport. It's 2 minutes left, fourth down, you're on E. How in the hell are you going to respond? And look, if you screw up, your teammate next to you might get his bell rung. There's nothing like it. So you do need leaders, legit leaders, people to follow who know how to navigate through this beautifully callous, cruel world. And I think the teams that have those leaders established, they respond in December. The teams that don't, they're going to quit and they're going to die and they're going to go through losing seasons. I think the Browns are trying to figure out those players. And I think Grant Delpit realizes he needs to be that player who kind of leads the charge.
Ty, we'll get you out of here at this. More of an overarching question in relation to the AFC. Because, listen, the Chiefs still a juggernaut in this conference, obviously, and they did make a run to the Super Bowl. They are still the defending AFC champions. But given how that Super Bowl went and how lopsided it was, do you kind of get the sense in people you've talked to, and I know you talk to teams all around the league, but from some of these teams that are like true Super Bowl or AFC contenders, the Bills, the Ravens, etc., do you get the sense that like these teams feel like maybe the Chiefs are vulnerable for the first time in a while to actually be beaten and overtaken in the playoffs, and that maybe this is their chance to sort of slip in and win a Super Bowl?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's blasphemy for us to talk like that, right? Like, it's taboo to think, yeah, oh my gosh, like the king is dead and they're done and it's their time has passed. And I don't think we're saying that, because I think we all know Andy Reid, Patrick Mahomes, they play the long game, right? This is Greg Popovich and Tim Duncan and the Spurs. Like, they'll use September and October to tinker and toy. I mean, it's crazy they won two more Super Bowls without Tyreek Hill and with an offense that was kind of a pop gun offense at times. They're still at the peak of their powers as long as Mahomes is the quarterback. But yeah, to your point, I think that they looked vulnerable. It's clear in the Philly Super Bowl and even the Tampa Super Bowl, the COVID year a while back. If you've got a D-line that can get pressure on Mahomes and you don't have to blitz, I mean, Vic Fangio didn't blitz one time in this Super Bowl. You think back to the Tampa one. What was the number? I think Mahomes ran around for 497 yards before getting sacked and before throwing incompletions. Like, he was running for his damn life against the Buccaneers in that game. You somehow have to get a pass rush without blitz. And if you've got that, and then you've got an offense of your own that can put up 30 points. Yeah. I mean, Bills have it. The Ravens have it. You know, the Bengals at least have the offense. Who in the hell knows what they're going to have on defense? I think every team that has one of those quarterbacks at least can stick with Mahomes, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody finally overtook them in the AFC. Probably not Cleveland quite yet, right? Not yet. You do have to figure out the quarterback position. But I think that they absolutely have a little – direction 1 through 53 on what in the hell they want this thing to look like from a roster standpoint.
Hey, we get it. You can only take the love for Cleveland so far at this point. We're right there with you. So Tyler,
I haven't been drinking yet. It's still a little early.
It is a Friday though, so I wouldn't blame you if you were. The weekend starts a little early. Tyler Dunn. He does a tremendous job covering just the NFL at large over at GoLongTD.com, his own site. Like I said, I mentioned it a couple times, but go check out that piece about Grant Delp. Really, really insightful stuff. Ty, you know I love having you on. You know I always love catching up. I hope we get a chance to do it in person at training camp at some point. But until I get to see you, man, take care of yourself, all right?
Hey, thanks so much, Spence. You as well. Great chat. Let's do it again soon.
Is the man for training camp, and he's brought to us by Scheiben Jewelers, Cleveland's premier jewelry store. You can get the latest from Browns training camp right now on our YouTube channel after you get done listening to this, because Daryl Ryder recaps each and every practice. He features the best highlights from coaches, players, during the media availability, and of course, all of the on-the-field action. So subscribe to 92.3 The Fan channel on YouTube right now. Get all of the latest from Daryl Ryder on the Browns throughout the football preseason.
It's good stuff. Daryl, how are you, my friend?
ID.
Hello, boys.
I have so many questions for you.
Well, I hopefully have so many answers for you. If not, I'll just make them up.
There you go.
I'm going to
cut. That's a gig right there.
I'm going to cut through the chase, right? Like, I know everyone wants to talk about the quarterback. Everybody wants to talk about, you know, maybe running back or what's going on in this team. Do you think that dude fell on purpose yesterday while he was taking the picture of the helmet? What's the story at camp? Because you know everyone's talking about it. Let's be honest.
As somebody who's the resident klutz at the radio station,
yes,
I could go either way. I fell flat on my face yesterday, so tripping over my own 2 feet. So I'm not going to lie. I've watched that video 150 times, and laughed each and every time and there's part of me that feels really guilty about it, mm-hmm, but then there's part of me that doesn't feel guilty about it. But if I were on that raft, that is exactly something I would do. So I'm riding the fence on that. I'm 50-50 between staged and the poor fella fell off the raft.
That jet ski sure showed up in a hurry, though.
Yeah, it did, right?
That's the only thing.
And they did happen to have a life raft there. Or
well, but it is not on a life raft, you know, though, a little ship there, and
yeah, I guess
little lake. There.
Oh, you do have to have one if you have to wear a life jacket there. So I don't know. We're going to kick that around a little bit later. But Daryl, I think that's the pressing question today. You can't tell me that isn't going to be the topic of conversation.
Well, I will say this. That's not on my list of questions to ask Andrew Berry.
You need to ask him. Ask him if they'll ever do it again. Maybe that'll be the way to do it. So, yeah, what do you think of the helmet?
Helmets came out great, though.
Yeah, what do you think of the helmet, Daryl? I know you're a big fan of jerseys and stuff like that, so.
Yeah, I think they did a really good job. I'll be honest with you, though. I would like to see that helmet with a white jersey and brown pants. I think that would be a spectacular uniform. I'm not all that crazy about the all brown uniform, but I also do like that they're bringing back the old Color Rush jersey, the brown uniform with the bright orange numerals there and lettering, because I did like those. I thought that those were pretty crisp and sharp. So, I think they did a nice job with the helmet. I'm a big, big fan of the white helmet. And I know this is somewhat sacrilegious, not somewhat, it is sacrilegious to say, but I like the white helmet more than I like the orange helmet these days, if I'm being completely honest with you. And I like that brown helmet, too, that they came up with.
I might be the only guy who would be all in favor of completely redoing everything. Just come up with something like the Seattle Seahawks did back in the day when they busted out their unis.
Well, Jeff,
you guys are both going to hate me because I wouldn't mind looking at a white helmet with the word Browns on the side of it in italics.
Yeah, no.
Moving forward, that wouldn't bother me either.
Yeah, I don't want anything on the helmet.
Have you ever seen the old helmet design, Daryl, that was rolled out in the 60s?
Yeah, the barely? CB, the ugly CB.
I didn't like that.
I have that. That helmet.
No kidding.
Yeah, but it was a kid's version of the helmet that came out in the 60s. I have it.
Yeah, I can't. Not a big fan of anything on the helmet.
Though. You wouldn't be in favor of any kind of a rollout like the Seahawks did when they kind of just.
No, because they already did that. They did that a couple years ago where the Oreo stripe had that carbon fiber. I guess decal incorporated in it. They changed the jerseys, and they were the ugliest jerseys in the NFL. Initially I liked
ours
them.
Ours are traditional now, but I wouldn't call them, great pieces of fashion.
Well, they're nice and clean. You never go with old fashioned simplicity. I like the fact that there's no drop shadow and all that other stuff, with the exception of the 1948. White throwback jersey. Love those, or 46 throwback jersey. I'm sorry. I love those jerseys. But I do like that the brown jersey is just nice and clean with just straight white lettering and numerals. And then I like that the white jersey has the brown lettering and numerals with no drop shadow. So big fan of nice, clean, simple.
Give me some insight here. Andy is adamant that they're not going to have four quarterbacks for long. I'm willing to have four quarterbacks into the season, even if you can get one to the practice squad. If Andy's right, and certainly he certainly could be, how are they going to decide which guy to get rid of and how quickly could they pare this thing down?
Well, Kevin Stefanski said yesterday that he hopes to begin that process potentially as early as next week, which I found to be somewhat interesting. The fact that they rolled Kenny Pickett out there again for the first true team 11-on-11. They did some 11-on-11 earlier, but it was more of a simulated, and you had some offensive players playing the defense there. But when you're talking true offense v. defense 11-on-11, it went Kenny Pickett, Dylan Gabriel, and then Shedeur Sanders. They know what they have in Joe Flacco. And we're going to hear from Joe Flacco today as well. So they don't. I don't think that they really have a sense of urgency to give him a lot of reps early in training camp right now. But I do agree with the thought they do need to pare this thing down. You can't run 3 weeks of a four-man quarterback competition, because I just don't know how you efficiently prepare for a season. And in a couple of weeks here, they're going to go to Carolina for a joint practice. Then the following week, they're going to Philadelphia for two joint practices, plus preseason games in both of those cities. I don't know how you can run an efficient four-man quarterback competition. And that's not, I'm not taking a shot at Kevin Stefanski or the organization or anything like that. It's just, I just think four is too many. I think you got to start paring it down as soon as possible so that you can begin the work of actually preparing for the upcoming season and getting your offensive players comfortable with whomever is going to be that starting quarterback.
If all four guys are healthy, Daryl, because this has been my argument, if all four guys are healthy, will there be four quarterbacks on the roster to start the season? I'm saying no. I think they trade one or they let one loose. I think it's more about a trade. But
I think that there will be four on the initial 53-man roster. And that because the league will call their bluff, right? If Andrew right. Berry's making phone calls or fielding phone calls about guys, you know how it goes, right, guys? The league's going to be like, yeah, we dare you to cut one of these guys. Okay, let's just see who you cut. And then you don't cut one of them. And then you get a little movement there to get whether it's a sixth or a seventh round pick. Because let's be honest about it, you're not going to get much for whoever gets voted off the island. So I do think that there's a very real possibility after the final cuts at the end of August, we'll go into that Wednesday morning with four quarterbacks on the initial 53-man roster.
But by Friday, it could be three.
Correct. Yeah.
You think you could sneak Shedeur Sanders onto the practice squad?
No.
Okay. I don't think so either.
No, yeah, I don't think you can sneak any of these guys, Jeff, on the practice squad. That's why I just, you know, because that's something that I was wrestling with early in the offseason where I'm like, yeah, you know, what if you cut one of these guys, you sneak them through waivers and you put them on the practice squad, you still keep the four guys. But I just, right now, as we have this discussion, I just don't see a pathway for that to be realistic.
And see, that's where I have this issue, Daryl. Shedeur is interesting. Dylan Gabriel is interesting. Pickett, I think, is interesting. Flacco, we know, can do some things, but he's older. And I just wonder what's going to scream out to the Browns that this guy doesn't deserve a spot on this roster. Because right. I think they could make a huge mistake.
Yeah. And this is the challenge that they have in front of them,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, without question.
Not only do you got to pick the right guy, you got to make sure you don't vote the wrong guy off the island.
That's
right?
exactly right.
Mm-hmm. You know, okay. Yeah. Now, you look at how Andrew Berry has handled his roster management in during his tenure as the EVP and GM there. He doesn't cut his draft picks in year one. So for me, Dylan Gabriel and Shedeur Sanders are going to be on this roster, which means along our premise in the conversation we're having here, logic dictates, right? Then they're making a choice between Kenny Pickett and Joe Flacco. And this is what I've been saying for the better part of the last month and a half. I do not believe that this is a true four-man quarterback competition for accuracy's sake and the messaging to fans. I have to say that, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what the organization is saying. I personally, though, don't see it that way. I see this as a two-man quarterback competition between Joe Flacco and Kenny Pickett.
I also think that when you look at this situation, like when Kevin first got here, he liked throwing to the tight ends and used a fullback. This is the first time we've had a fullback on the roster in a couple of years. And if Troy Harrison gets cut, then I think maybe there is a chance they keep four quarterbacks. I just, the thought of having three guys on the roster that will not take the field at all during a game, whether you know, put them on reserve or whatever you're doing,
right?
I can't see that making sense. You can't yeah. have three guys that do not go on the field during any, have a chance to not go on the field at all during a game.
Well, here's my thing, and we've seen
it's
this.
Truthfully too, but
yeah,
no, sorry.
I mean, we've seen this in years past, right? And I'll say this is respectfully and delicately as possible. These things tend to take care of themselves.
You're correct.
Okay, and that's how I'll leave it. Like some of these, we've seen this, whether it's been running back competitions, receiver competitions, anywhere along the roster, right? These situations tend to take care of themselves. So I am just kind of sitting back here the first couple of practices this week and just kind of soaking it in. We'll see where we are in about a week from now. As far as this, as I put in air quotes, four-man quarterback competition goes.
If it's between Flacco and Pickett, that must mean that they, if that's accurate, Daryl, and no reason to think it might not be, they got to think Shedeur Sanders or Dylan Gabriel is ready to be a backup quarterback in the NFL. Do you think they'll reach that conclusion?
Well, I mean, they did that with Dorian Thompson-Robinson, right?
Well, how'd that work out?
I don't dispute you.
No,
and this is the other thing I keep trying to hammer home to fans. Like, it's great that Shedeur has the following that he does, and he's as popular as he is and whatnot, right? I'm trying to be fair to him. He's a fifth-round pick. It's not fair of me to sit here and expect that he's the starting quarterback week one. He's a fifth-round pick. He's a project. He's a developmental project. Same thing goes for Dylan Gabriel.
And that's all okay, Daryl.
Yes. That, again, not a criticism at all.
Exactly.
Not a criticism of Shedeur. That's not a criticism of the Browns. Like, not a criticism of Dylan Gabriel. Like, they are both projects. They're both developmental prospects. And there's no issue with that whatsoever.
Nope. I agree completely. Yep.
But that's where you have to make the right decision, though, between Joe Flacco and Kenny Pickett to hold down the fort this year. Because if they're true developmental projects, they should, it should not be in the plans for them to see the field this year, okay? Because they need to sit for a year and watch and observe. And then, of course, you have to make the evaluation next offseason. Okay, even though they didn't play, how do we like things behind the scenes and how they handle practice and week preparation going into weeks and things like that? And then how does that fit into our big picture of having two first-round picks and needing to potentially still draft a franchise quarterback? These are all questions that are not easy to answer, but they're at some point going to have to be answered. But yeah, I don't have the sense of urgency to put either one of those kids on the field right now because, A, I don't think it's fair because of where they were drafted, and B, I think sometimes you could potentially do more harm than good, and you go back and you look at the 40 quarterbacks the Browns have run through that building over the last 26 seasons, right? The Deshaun Kaisers of the world, the Charlie Fries of the world. Like, when has that ever happened? Cody Kessler, Dorian Thompson-Robinson. When has it ever paid true dividends for this franchise playing mid to late quarterback picks in the draft as rookies? It has never paid off for them. And I don't suspect that all of a sudden we're going to have this eureka moment, and it is now.
Daryl, you've been out there for the mini camp, so you were out there for the first day yesterday. Is there truly a different attitude about practicing hard and playing harder and trying to get more out of practice right now? And, you know, I know in the past we've kind of laughed about Camp Cupcake, but I don't. Is that clear and obvious that that is not what this year is going to be about?
Well, it's too early. I mean, they ran a 70-minute practice.
Yeah, but I mean, going into this thing, you tell me.
They're talking about it. I mean, they're talking about it. But yeah, listen, if I had a dollar for every time the Browns talked about something, and I'd be on a beach somewhere sipping my drink with an umbrella in it, a la Mike Holmgren. But, we'll see here as we get at least a week into this thing. I will say this, the one thing you can see that there's an intentionality about maximizing the time that they do have on the field. And I think Kevin Stefanski, and he talked about it yesterday, he really is trying to balance efficiency. And that is, you know, splitting these quarterbacks, doing reps on separate fields with them, while also at the same time making sure that he's not gassing his players early in camp.
So how did we get to this point, Daryl, though, that we're sitting here questioning how tough guys are working in practice? And did part of that have to do
with the 3-14 last year?
Well, but the other question, though, is about the offensive line coach and making sure that you have one in there that's pushing the offensive line.
Well, Mike Vrabel was coaching the offensive line in September. So that told you how that was going.
How things changed. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll say this. You know, DeJuan Jones looks great. Physically, he looks great. It remains to be seen. Can he stay healthy? That's the question. Jack Conklin, can he stay healthy? If that line stays healthy, okay, and it's, for me, that's the key. Aside from the quarterback situation offensively, it's can the offensive line stay healthy? Because if they can stay healthy, that's going to be one of the strengths of this football team. It's going to help them run the ball. It's certainly going to help the quarterback as far as giving them extra time to process and get the ball out, right, and make plays down the field. So for me, offensively, aside from who they pick a quarterback and the, you know, can we get competent quarterback play, the health of the offensive line might be the second most important thing on that side of the football.
Daryl, last thought. What do the Browns have option-wise when it comes to Quinshon Judkins right now?
Well, right now, it's I think that they're handling the situation. And again, we're going to hear from Andrew Berry, and I'm sure he will address it because he will be asked a lot of questions about it. You keep him unsigned. You wait for the legal resolution to the situation. He's certainly not getting a fully guaranteed contract now. That's out the door. Because I don't know in what world you can now do that if you're the Browns, right? So Quinshon, from just a pure business football standpoint, setting the accusation aside, okay, and just looking at through the lens of football in business, this was a bad situation
bad.
For him.
Yep.
And you know, if the allegations are true, which we don't know if they are, if the allegations are true, then obviously that's some pretty awful decision making on his part to get himself in a situation like that. So I think the Browns are handling from a business standpoint, Jeff, as best as you can. Got to get the legal resolved. There's no hurry there for the Browns to put pen to paper on a contract. And then obviously, too, the other tentacle of this is the NFL is doing their own investigation. We know how quickly they moved on Mike Hall Jr. His incident happened in mid-August. And it took him about a month to come up with, you know, that 5-game suspension to start the season. So there's also the league component to this as well.
Daryl, thank you. YouTube is where we're catching you right now, right, to make sure we can see all the good and daily reports.
Thanks, D.
We'll be listening to you throughout the day. Thanks, Daryl.